So I'm here today to talk to you all about our work to assess hospital stewardship efforts in LA County and their readiness to support skilled nursing facilities with stewardship activities. So this session is about resistance, and as we all know, antimicrobial stewardship is one of the best ways to fight the evolution and spread of resistance in our communities. In California, we've been lucky to have a number of laws and regulations enacted over the past several years that contribute directly to the work that we do. In 2008, we were the first in the nation to require hospitals to implement methods to have judicious antimicrobial use. In 2015, California mandated that all acute care hospitals must have stewardship in place. And now in 2017, skilled nursing facilities are also required to have stewardship in place. We expected that because of these regulations, our facilities might be a bit more advanced in their practices. More to come on that later. But studies have shown that SNFs do have a higher rate of inappropriate prescribing of antibiotics, which means that their patients are at greater risk for potentially harboring drug-resistant pathogens. And this is somewhat alarming because of the role that SNFs have in their patient-sharing networks. This social network diagram, created by Mary Hayden and her colleagues, demonstrates how CRE-positive patients can move within a network of healthcare facilities. So I'm going to quickly go over the legend. The green dots are nursing homes. Does the arrow show up? No, I guess not. The green dots are nursing homes. Yellow dots are acute care hospitals. Red dots are long-term acute care facilities, or LTACs. And the blue triangles are case patients. The lines indicate the connections between different healthcare facilities, and the red lines mean that a carbapenemase was identified. So just looking at patient one, which is kind of in the top, in the middle of the corner, you can see that this patient is moving between four different kinds of healthcare facilities. And looking at the green dots, which are the nursing homes, you can see that SNFs are indeed quite connected in this network. So because patient sharing networks do play a role in spreading resistant organisms, prevention programs can be more effective if facilities work together to have a collaborative impact on the stopping the spread of organisms within their region. In 2015, the CDC modeled data from Orange County and compared intervention scenarios that either included a coordinated approach, which is the dotted line below, or a common approach, non-coordinated, which was the solid line above. What was found in this model is that a network approach did greatly reduce the prevalence of CRE in a region over time. Now, LA County has almost 100 hospitals and over 400 skilled nursing facilities. We also have a high CDI rate and a high CRE rate as well. So because it's difficult for the healthcare outreach unit team to provide direct assistance to all skilled nursing facilities, we hoped that facilities would begin to coordinate efforts to stop the spread in the region. We feel that our role as public health is to facilitate these relationships, to make them care about each other, so then we can create an avenue for them to share resources and best practices for both stewardship and infection prevention. But first, we needed data. And because we're epidemiologists, we need that data for action, right? So we developed a survey with the goals of assessing the status of hospital ASPs to identify ways in which we can best support them and to determine whether hospitals were willing and ready to assist their skilled nursing facilities with implementing stewardship elements. Our unit's liaison public health nurses, or LPHNs, utilized their existing relationships with hospitals to obtain their ASP champion's contact information. We then emailed out this Google survey to the ASP champions during the 2015 Get Smart About Antibiotics Week. Our LPHNs and student volunteers conducted telephone follow-up for non-responders, and in the end, we were able to get a total of 51 responses. In comparing the respondents to the non-respondents, we found that our hospitals were a representative sample in terms of number of IPs, bed size, and average daily census. So when we got to analyzing the data, we first looked at the characterization of ASP committees. We saw a good representation of pharmacists, physicians, and IPs, but less of nurses and microbiologists, who are also playing very important roles in supporting stewardship efforts in facilities. When asked how many hospitals had pharmacists and physicians available for consultation, we were actually quite shocked to find that most hospitals did have physicians available for consult, and about two-thirds did have pharmacists available for consult. So this began to give us hope about how advanced our stewardship programs might be, which led to our next question, where we asked hospital ASP champions to self-report what tier their program is at, using the definitions as defined by the California Department of Public Health Spotlight on Hospital ASP Programs, which has since changed. And I'm not going to go into each tier, but I just wanted to point out that to go above and beyond the basic program into the intermediate program, hospitals needed to have guidelines, monitoring, and education in place. And then to go beyond that into an advanced program, they also needed to have formulary restriction and prospective audits in place. Implementation of these specific elements does require additional time and resources, so these differences speak to a hospital's potential capacity to assist other facilities. However, we were a little saddened to learn that only about 40% of the respondents were meeting advanced elements. For those 31 respondents that were not meeting the advanced elements, we asked them what their biggest barriers were to implementing those advanced elements. We found that the barriers that had a moderate to major impact were insufficient protected time for ASP activities, insufficient funding, insufficient interest from medical staff, or support from their IT team. So we then provided a list of possible ways that our unit could best support stewardship activities in our jurisdiction. The three that hospital ASP champions considered to be very or extremely important for us to provide to them were regional guidelines for stewardship practices, guidelines for syndrome-specific antimicrobials, and education of non-ASP providers on stewardship. These helped us better understand what hospitals look to us for and what our role is as public health in our county. So the next part was learning about hospitals' readiness and beginning to coordinate this regional approach to CDI and CRE prevention. Because if hospitals are to serve as the experts, we needed to know if they were ready to support their key partners. So, as it turned out, most hospital ASP champions were at least somewhat aware of a network of skilled nursing facilities with which their hospital shared patients. However, 80% of them simply did not know whether or not the skilled nursing facilities that they were connected to had any ASP elements in place. And the remaining 20% were split between knowing for sure whether or not the SNFs had elements in place. So next, we asked how likely these ASP champions were to provide various types of stewardship support to their network SNFs. And honestly, we kind of expected these answers to come out to be unlikely, but we were surprised to see that a lot of hospitals actually were quite likely to provide some level of support. We did also find that hospitals with an advanced program status were more likely to provide this type of support, but that difference was not found to be significant statistically. So of the 7 hospitals that responded in the survey that they were extremely likely to provide some sort of support, I reached out to them to see if they had any sort of outreach activities going on. And at the time, all had identified their most connected SNFs and were either beginning to or already were doing some sort of educational outreach or on-site consultations. So because of this unexpected capacity of hospitals being ready, we felt that we could start leveraging our existing relationships with our acute care hospitals in building a support system for our SNFs in meeting and hopefully exceeding ASP requirements. We envisioned something like this, where the HOU helps to facilitate engagement and collaboration between hospitals and their networked skilled nursing facilities. The HOU will serve as the convener, the source of guidance and expertise, and when necessary, the shoulder to cry on. So moving forward, we are working with several hospitals to support stewardship and infection prevention projects with their network SNFs, including one payer-based system. This year, the LA County Healthcare Associated Infections and Antimicrobial Resistance Committee formed 2 task forces to develop and disseminate the requested support that the champions had asked us for. The HOU will continue to maintain close relationships with our hospital partners to learn of best practices that can then be shared with others so that together we can resist the resistance. I'd like to thank my team and thank you all for listening.
That was fantastic. All of you, thank you so much. So now we can go ahead and begin taking questions. And then I don't know if you guys want to come up here to make it a little bit easier to get up to the mic. There's a microphone in the middle of the room, or if you have a really loud voice, although we usually prefer microphones.
Marion Kona, Tennis and Department of Health. Angela, you have mentioned in terms of your plans that you were going to get an inpatient data feed. Can you describe just a little bit more what that involves?
Right, so right now our syndromic surveillance feed only has ED data. So what we need to do is get the inpatient data for last name, first name, date of birth from the hospitals. As far as the technical specifics, I'm not too familiar with that. Megan from Mariah, she's been working on it.
So to clarify, it's basically ADT data that you're looking for? Or are you looking for actual diagnoses?
ADT data, so admissions data.
Okay, thank you. And Medora, I had a question for you, or a comment and a question. So just to clarify, the position statement which we're discussing is on CPCRE, so it's only nationally notifiable if you are carbapenemase producing, not the definition, not the phenotypic definition of CRE per se. So just a comment for clarification for folks. When we were writing the position statement in 2015, we were concerned about the Enterobacter, because we were concerned that there may be some lack of specificity, and the decision was made that this was such a complex definition, but we didn't want to do something separate for Enterobacter compared to Klebsiella and E. coli in terms of saying don't count the erdapenem. But I think your data actually suggests that all of us that have been collecting such data should look at that and see whether we may want to modify that definition. So I really applaud you for looking at the data that way. There were also comments on that position statement, should we take Enterobacter out of the equation altogether? And we did look in Tennessee at that, and 48% of our KPC producers in Tennessee are Enterobacters, so we can't exclude Enterobacters, but maybe we can get rid of the erdapenem portion of the case definition. So anyway, very, very nice work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. This was all wonderful. It's really, I think, you know, really great work on all sorts of levels related to antimicrobial resistance, which is really, I think, it's a wonderful panel. Yeah, I mean, what Mary just talked about, I think, is really important. I'm a little worried about getting too, as you were saying, too complex in the definition, unless we're very automated. But you know, you have compelling data to show that there's a lot of noise in that system. I guess, you know, one of the things, you know, in terms of the annual survey for long-term care facilities. Any thoughts about that? You know, your survey in Hawaii, I think, is really great. Maybe as a tool we can also use to try to validate as we go forward and start collecting annual surveys on long-term care facilities as now they gear up and start getting into, into NHSN in some big way. In our state, there's very few right now, but they're coming on. And they start doing the annual survey, I really worry, and we already worry about the kind of the quality of the data from, you know, acute care hospitals, but also from, long-term care hospitals, I'd be very concerned about, you know, is this good data that we can really act on? And I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, since, you know, it sounds like you've already collecting good data that could be maybe kind of built into some sort of a validation tool eventually to try to make sure that we're tracking this over time and we're getting granular enough.
Yeah, so I definitely think you bring up a good point. In Hawaii, we have a very limited capacity in our HAI department, and Z has been doing excellent work in really bringing facilities on board, and I'm not sure if it's like this in other states, but in Hawaii, it's really important that you first make the personal relationships, and then you can start talking about the data. And so I think what we're doing right now is trying to collect this data and get these work groups started so that we can begin having these discussions. And then the quality of the data would be something that once we have the relationships, we can bring up how this data should be entered, what specifically we're looking for, because already we saw in our survey that there already is some confusion about what these ASP programs might look like, what the data actually is asking for. So moving forward, we definitely are at those initial stages and getting those long-term care facilities into NHSN and reporting. So I think it's working with them to try and make sure that that data is accurate.
I think as many voice-to-voice contacts and things as possible. Yeah, we had a rather amusing call with one of our hospitals when we were kind of feeding them back, you know, their antimicrobial, their annual survey. This is acute care, right? And there's like a whole group of them on the telephone having arguments about where the data came from. And somebody, you know, it's in the gray. You got it from the gray filing cabinet, you know, in Joe's office. You know, that's where we got the data. So I think you're right. That it improves the data, but then of course they have to do something with the data. So thank you.
Hi, Kelsey O'Young from Los Angeles County. I have a couple of questions for Suzanne, two if you don't mind. I was wondering if you have any hypotheses for why you saw the differences between the peds and the adult prescribing outcomes.
Okay, that's actually a good question. I actually had to cut that for my presentation for time. So we did ask the practice that shared their data with us, and they were saying that they believed that the peds, there was more of a difference with that because parents were more open to watchful waiting and delayed prescribing practices for their children versus the adults with the bronchitis. They wanted their prescription then and there. So that's what they believe the difference was.
Sure. Now, my second question is, did you capture any implementation science measures during the process? So, like, did you find any predictors that were associated with improved prescribing? So, like, organizational readiness or the attitudes and beliefs of the prescribers or more leadership support in those practices that had better outcomes?
No, because we just did the survey that we just distributed were to the providers that participated in the campaign. So we did not collect information on that.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, Z from Hawaii. Question for you, Suzanne.
Mm-hmm.
Could you speak a little bit more about your potential collaborative with your QIO and how that's going to shake up?
So I think this is something that's being done among all the Quinn QIOs. So they're started an outpatient stewardship initiative where they're helping outpatient facilities implement the core elements of outpatient stewardship. And so I think the work that we've done in our campaign would be a good bridge for that because it does include several of the elements. So other activities of the campaign that I didn't mention, so we were doing some educational webinars. As I mentioned, we interviewed and things like that. So there are other components of the campaign, but the main intervention was the commitment poster.
The webinars for the providers?
Yes, the webinars were for the providers.
My name is Chris Chaya from Colorado Department of Public Health, and I want to thank you all for a great session. I have a question for Alexandra. So we've been working with nursing homes for antimicrobial stewardship as well, and I've had the opportunity to both informally survey them about core elements and then work with several of them in person. And one thing I was struck by your survey was that quite a few of them actually had antimicrobial stewardship expertise, even if it wasn't most, it was more than what I've seen, and a lot of pharmacy involvement. So my question is, do you have insights on how best to involve the contract pharmacists in doing antimicrobial stewardship with these facilities?
So we do have pharmacy involved in our collaborative, and through that we have an individual who has the College of Pharmacy involved and will educate the pharmacists on proper use of antimicrobials and on stewardship in general. And so I think because the UH pharmacists are being educated on that stewardship, that is helpful for us. Do you want to?
Also, so we talked about long-term care,
also to keep in mind that these they are self-reported expertise, so making sure that moving forward there is some parameter and making sure that there are those baselines for what is expertise and how we can move that forward.
So Richard Brooks, DHQP CDC field assignee at Maryland Health Department. My question's for the last speaker. I was curious to know if you ran into any issues with either providers or facilities from a sort of risk standpoint or legal standpoint in terms of them providing technical assistance or guidance to facilities. I would be surprised if people were just not hesitant about the liability they may be opening themselves up to by providing that sort of assistance to people.
Thank you for that question. It's fantastic. As you can tell by my face, I honestly don't know.
Okay.
I don't know if, Don, you have any comments on that.
Good. I'm glad you haven't, but...
No, thank you.
This is Lei Chen from Washoe County, Nevada. So I have two quick questions for Angela regarding your registry. So is that participation in your registry is a part of the mandatory or just a voluntary based? I know reporting is a
Right. Reporting CRE is mandatory to the XDR registry.
Okay.
That's our surveillance system.
So participation in the registration is also the mandatory as well, right?
Yes.
Okay. So is that a part of the VA hospital? Is a part of your registry?
We do have VA hospitals participating.
Okay, great. Thank you. One more question for Philadelphia's presenter, the first MCR one. So I'm not sure if I remember correctly. I read some articles regarding the MCR1 screening in the environmental samples in those Asian countries. Like they found some like genes in the seafood or something like that. So I'm just curious to know if for your case, did you ask for those kind of dietary or food consumption, those kind of history,
Yeah, that's a good question. We had asked questions. We had focused a lot on livestock, on farm-type exposures, on retail meats. This was a patient who had a fairly complex medical history and really hadn't been involved in much of that, hadn't had any really unusual types of foods. So I think that we really didn't have any good leads of what we might test. There was it was a fairly typical diet. It was store-bought grocery. I mean, there was really, there wasn't a good lead on any type of food to test.
Thank you.
I actually wanted to ask you more about your interaction with the media, because as we know, Reuters has taken a great interest in our ATI work. And so I've also had to speak with various local media outlets and so forth, and so I think it's always good to keep track of experiences that public health is having with the media and sort of what the feeling about that is, if you don't mind.
Sure. So we, in epidemiology, were sort of providing some background information, and we were liaising primarily through our communications department. So they were really on the front line. So when questions from reporters would come in, they would get forwarded up, and we would look at it and we would answer it and send it back to our communications department. And then they would say, we're not saying any of that. and nobody knows what you're talking about. Try again. It was interesting, though, that it was really multifaceted. So this was a really collaborative investigation with CDC, and they actually took a lot of the initiative and some of the talking points, and I know that there had been some testimonies. I know that there had been some interest from some legislators, and that was something that CDC really sort of buffered on our behalf, and we were really grateful for. And one thing I didn't really talk about, this had been tested through DOD, so then there was another agency. And so I know that their public information officer was also really quite involved. And I remember talking to a physician who was concerned. So one thing that we'd heard anecdotally is that reporters were calling different local hospitals, and I think they were trying to just catch someone off guard. And there was concern that they might do that at a clinic. And I remember them asking, like, well, what would we do? I was like, well, what would you do if it was, like, anything else? I don't know anything. Talk to my public information officer. And so in the interest of, like, sort of protecting confidentiality, especially when we really didn't have a lot of good answers, we were sort of really using our communications offices not only just like as a tool to communicate general information but also sort of as protection so that we could focus on the investigation.
Okay. Hi, Stephanie Black, Chicago Department of Public Health. Thank you for the presentations. My questions for Sandy. I was interested in how LA County, you are supporting the acute care facilities in working with the SNFs. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned developing syndromic-specific guidelines and regional guidelines for practice. And I just wondered if you did that in collaboration with pharmacists at the acute care facilities or how you went about doing that.
So to answer, it's not working. Okay, I'll just stand, I guess. So to answer your first question, the way we kind of envision, well, we have 5 liaison public health nurses that work with every single hospital in LA County, and they have pretty great relationships. And we now also have a ID physician on our staff part-time. So he and the LPHNs together form like a pretty good team that can do outreach to the hospitals, give them like whatever sort of guidance and support. Our team also has been undergoing a leading effective collaborations training. So we formed like this team. We're calling ourselves the Antimicrobial Resistance Network. We need to find something more catchy. Don hates the name. So we, you know, are working to foster these relationships with the SNFs. And I mean, we've only worked with several thus far. So our experience isn't very great, but hopefully this time next year we'll have a little bit more on that. And then as far as developing the regional guidelines, so our Healthcare-Associated Infections and Antimicrobial Resistance Committee has representation from physicians, pharmacists, and they developed a task force that does, I believe, include 2 physicians, 2 IPs, 2 MDs, and some of our staff. And they're still kind of brainstorming on how to best come up with these guidelines because it is kind of tricky when LA County is so huge. So again, hopefully in the next year or so, we'll actually have something and give more information then. I think you have my contact information. If you want to know more, you can always reach out. Yeah. Yep.
Again, from Washoe County, Nevada, I just wanted to share our experience in handling with the first pandemic, pan-resistant, NDMCRE case published in January 13, MMWR. It's overwhelming. I had a chance to kind of participate in the media response because our PIO was busy with the flood response in our community. So it's really the CDC prepared the talking points for us. We really appreciate that. But the first question I was asked by the STAT news reporter was what antibiotic classes you have done for the testing. So a lot of questions we didn't prepare, but because of we investigated the whole case and we still can't able to answer. The protect the patient's confidentiality is really key because there's so many international kind of news reporter track us down to wanted to know who that person is, what the race, ethnicity, so wanted to develop some stories. So it's very overwhelming for the FBE to be part of the media response. We received 26 news media inquiry from the nation and in the world as well. Total 57 from the, total inquiry, half of them from the media. So just wanted to share.
That one thing I wanted to add that I think sometimes we forget about is that the patients themselves also are able to watch the news. And we were working with our patient and we had a lot of our messaging, and then all of a sudden we would be like, just to let you know, there's probably going to be like a lot of stories this weekend, and then all of a sudden we were talking to the patient, was like, I have the super bug, and it's like the end of like treatment. We're like, okay, so like let's start again with like, you know, what we talked about. Like nothing changed between like today and yesterday. All that changed is that it's, you know, in the media now, and like this is their job. They have to tell a story. So that was really interesting for us to have that additional aspect of trying to talk to a patient who felt a lot of pressure and was very concerned that like one day someone would knock on the door and it would be a reporter. But thankfully, that did not happen.
Hi, Rich Melkreich, CSTE. I forgot to know. I think that's interesting. That was one of the things I was going to ask you about. I have two questions. One, I just got answered, I think, or maybe I just make a point about that. I remember back in the day I worked in the HIV program, not the HAI program, and you know the issue of stigma is really, I think, can be very scary, especially with these people, as you say, with, you know, superbugs going to infect the world and kill everybody, and there'll be no antibiotics left. And you know, we had, I think, MCR one, we had the second case, I think, in Connecticut, and that was a huge issue for reasons I won't exactly get into, protect the patient's confidentiality. But, you know, that we're very concerned that the word spreads and you very quickly could really stigmatize those individuals and really turn them into pariahs. And I don't know if you ran into some of that.
No, I mean, you will note that we tested 20 persons who had had contact with this person. That's quite a few. And our patient was really great and asked a lot of questions like, do I need to tell my neighbors? Is there something they need to do? We're like, no, actually, we recommend you don't. if they didn't come in your house and like help you with some pretty, you know, personal things, like they don't need to know what happened. And we really appreciate that, you know, this patient was very thoughtful and you know, absolutely didn't want to transmit this to anyone else. It was definitely, there was definitely a concern about feeling stigmatized and feeling like this, this nightmare superbug was, you know, somehow her fault, and there was a lot of messaging on like these things get transmitted, and we're just gonna move forward.
Yeah, thank you. For Alexandra and Sandy, you know, you talk about the, I think, a lot of really interesting ways to try to get at antimicrobial stewardship in long-term care facilities. But one thing that I think always is a concern is turnover, and I don't know if, you know, maybe your model in LA or what you're trying to do through assessment in Hawaii, do you have any insights from your experience that could help us deal with that concern we always run into, is the turnover in long-term care?
Yeah, so we do see a lot of turnover. We are trying to get within our work group a solid core group so that there are other members of long-term care facility who are part of that work group. And then also providing educational materials that can be given even if there is turnover, that we can provide for them. Additionally, ensuring that they know that we are a resource and that they can reach out to us. And Z goes into a lot of the facilities and we'll do hand hygiene trainings or work with them. And just really what we're trying to do is build those relationships, because once we have a relationship with the facility at large, it makes it a lot easier to deal with that turnover. And once these stewardship programs become part of the long-term care facility, it shouldn't matter if there's turnover, because that's just the way they do things now. And that's really what we're trying to get at.
One thing LA County has noticed is a lot of SNFs will start using one email address, like a generic one, that like staff, as they turn over, just use the same generic email address. However, again, there's 400 skilled nursing facilities in LA, and we have one nurse dedicated to them currently, hopefully more in the future, I don't know. So being able to get in touch with all of them is pretty difficult. We haven't really found a great way to maintain contact with all of them. Like, we have our listserv, and we try to email them every now and then with updates, but it's quite tricky there. That's all I'll say for now. Sorry.
Hi, DJ from Indiana. I had a question for Kelly. So one of your conclusions was that there was no protocol for investigating an MCR1 case. So in the aftermath, has there been that sort of development, maybe for like a standardized case investigation form within Pennsylvania or anything like that?
That's a good question. Not exactly. We did develop a questionnaire. We developed some of our criteria for stratifying risk. I think that the steps that we outlined were things that we all still would do if this were to occur again. And that was actually one of our decisions in sharing our investigation, is that these were some of our proposed methods for investigation. But as far as actually formalizing into some sort of protocol, we haven't taken that step.
It's Rich Milk, right again. Just
and Rich, this is going to be the last question.
Okay, and this is just a very quick follow-up. But CORHA, the Council on Outbreak something, 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 you know, I don't know, I don't know if you've had a chance to make some learnings from what your experience might be very helpful for them, and then for the rest of us through that mechanism.
Great, thanks.
Okay, I remembered what I was going to say. LA County developed our own interfacility transfer form, and what we found when we were kind of piloting-ish the form at an 8-bit group was that it was actually also really helpful to attach a sheet where facilities were able to document contacts at each other's facilities. So when you receive the transfer form, who do you contact? Who is it supposed to go to? Who can you get to if you need more questions? So I think that's what we're going to kind of try to propose, is to keep those contact sheets as updated as possible between the healthcare facilities, especially as part of our ongoing network project. Thanks.
I think that's an excellent data field that has been left off of most transfer forms. Very good point. All right, well, I want to thank the presenters for some fantastic presentations.